Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So, this is there, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 32, Entanglement in Fruitive Activities. Text 2.
Sa
chapi
chapi
bhagava
bhagava
dharma
dharma
kama
kama
buddha
buddha
para
para
mukha
mukha
yajate
yajate
kratubir
kratubir
deva
deva
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Sachapi Bhagavad Dharma
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Kama Mudha Paramukha
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Yajate Kratubhir Deva
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Pitrims Cha Shradayan Vita
Saha
Hi
Cha Api
Cha Api
Moreover
Bhagavat Dharma
From devotional service
From devotional service
Kama Mudha
Kama Mudha
Infatuated by lust
Infatuated by lust
Parak Mukha
Parak Mukha
Having the face turned away Yajate worships
Kratubi
with sacrificial ceremonies
Deva
the demigods
Pitrim
the forefathers
Cha
and Shradayan Vita Shradaya
with faith
Anvitaha
endowed
Translation Such persons are ever bereft of devotional service due to being too attached to sense gratification and therefore although they perform various kinds of sacrifices and take great vows to satisfy the demigods and forefathers, they are not interested in Krishna consciousness, devotional service. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 20, It is said that persons who worship demigods have lost their intelligence. Kamaistaistaya ritigyana. They are much attracted to sense gratification, and therefore they worship the demigods. It is, of course, recommended in the Vedic scriptures that if one wants money, health, or education, then he should worship the various demigods. A materialistic person has manifold demands, and thus there are manifold demigods to satisfy his senses. The Grihamedis, who want to continue a prosperous materialistic way of life, generally worship the demigods or the forefathers by offering pinda, or respectful oblations. Such persons are bereft of Krishna consciousness and are not interested in devotional service to the Lord. This kind of so-called pious and religious man is the result of impersonalism. The impersonalists maintain that the Supreme Absolute Truth has no form, and that one can imagine any form he likes for his benefit and worship in that way. Therefore, the Grihamedis, or materialistic men, say that they can worship any form of a demigod as worship of the Supreme Lord. Especially amongst the Hindus, those who are meat eaters prefer to worship goddess Kali, because it is prescribed that one can sacrifice a goat before that goddess. They maintain that whether one worships goddess Kali or the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu or any demigod, the destination is the same. This is first class rascaldom. And such people are misled. But they prefer this philosophy. Bhagavad Gita does not accept such rascaldom. And it is clearly stated that such methods are meant for persons who've lost their intelligence. The same judgment is confirmed here. And the word kama mudha, meaning one who has lost his sense or is infatuated by the lust of attraction for sense gratification, is used. Kama mudhas are bereft of Krishna consciousness and devotional service, and are infatuated by a strong desire for sense gratification. The worshippers of demigods are condemned both in Bhagavad Gita and in Srimad Bhagavatam. Sachapi Bhagavad Dharmat Kama Mudha Paran Mukha Yajate Kratubhya Devan Pitrims Cha Shradayam Vita. Such persons are ever bereft of devotional service due to being too attached to sense gratification. And therefore, although they perform various kinds of sacrifices and take great vows to satisfy the demigods and forefathers, they're not interested in Krishna consciousness, devotional service. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shumati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namne Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharne Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastritya Deshitarne Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasani Gaur Bhakta Vrinda
Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare
Vancha Kapatrulibhyas Chakripa Sindhu Vyavacha Padidhanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Yes, so continuing the discussion, the description about these Grihamedis, people who are just too much attached to sense gratification. And in this particular verse of purport, their attachment to demigod worship is being smashed to pieces, just pulled apart and destroyed. Prabhupada calls this type of demigod worship and the impersonal type of demigod worship, in which the worshipper claims that you can worship anyone. You can worship anyone, it doesn't make any difference. I like worshipping Kali, so I'll worship Kali. You like worshipping Durga, so go ahead, worship Durga. You like worshipping Hanuman as a demigod, worship Hanuman. And you like worshipping who? Someone. Muruga. There are many demigods. You may not have heard of some of them, or quite a few even. So you worship Muruga? Very good. And you worship Madhaviran? Excellent. And you want to worship Vishnu? Oh, go ahead. No problem. It's all the same. Just different methodologies for doing the same things. Like you can, so many things you can do in different ways. You can speak in different languages. You can say the same thing in different languages. Even you can say the same thing in the same language, in one language, in different ways, but you say the same thing. So you can worship different gods, but it all ends up, it's the same. Because as you know, all roads lead to Rome. Well, unfortunately for them, since whenever they invented that saying, they built more roads. And now there's many roads, and they just don't go to Rome at all. I mean, there's still some that go to Rome. So, yes, there is a form of demigod worship which is even accepted in the very broad context of, according to the system of the Vedic literatures, gradually progressing from a low materialistic level, gradually coming higher, and then gradually you get into some form of yoga which is more spiritual, like particularly karma yoga or jnana yoga. And then gradually you come to devotional service, and gradually then eventually you go back to Godhead. So according to the Vedic literatures, that the demigod worship being described there is not Sri Sri Gaunadaya Ki Jai. So the fact is that the demigod worship being described in the Vedic literatures is not meant to be, it is not intended to be, some independent alternative process. If you want to go back to Godhead, okay. You want to stay in the material world, okay. Yeah, you can choose. You want to merge into the Brahma Jyoti, okay. The demigod worship being described in the Vedic literatures is meant to be part of a greater process which ends up in the person going back home, back to Godhead. This is actually what the arrangement is. But the arrangement is being misused. The arrangement is misunderstood. and then is being misused on the basis of these misunderstandings. So our acharyas refer to that very broad and very gradual process which eventually leads to Krishna consciousness step by step through various other disciplines. You come to devotional service, then you go back to Godhead. They refer to it as the yoga ladder. You may have heard that term before. It's quite regularly used in seminars on Bhagavad Gita. So the demigod worship, actual demigod worship, is meant to be one step in a multi-step process which ultimately will take you back home, back to Godhead. It's not meant to be that if you just feel, well, you know, I like this material world, I want to stay here and enjoy. I want to eat, drink, and be merry. Yeah. So the good way to do that is through demigod worship. That's the pious and nice way to do it. You can always just work hard in the factory and acquire resources, and with those resources acquire different items for enjoyment. You could even rob a bank or two and acquire your resources, your money that way, and acquire your facilities for sense gratification that way. But we want to do it very nicely and really minimize whatever negativity or sinful activity may be involved, so we'll worship the demigods. And we'll get the same things, but in a nice way, in a pious way. So this is a misunderstanding of what is demigod worship. This is a misunderstanding of what is the whole Vedic system. There are different types of popular misunderstandings. This is one of them. Another one is that the Vedic literatures are there to encourage us to merge into the Brahma-jyoti. That sort of idea, impersonalism. And then you get hybrids. Hybrids means combinations. Take the best out of demigod worship. Take the best out of impersonalism and make a process out of that. So we will worship the demigods and then merge in the Brahma-jyoti. It's a double. You achieved double. Well done. Something like that. Prabhupada here is particularly criticizing the impersonal, this sort of combined idea. As we mentioned earlier, you can worship in any demigod, it's all the same. But it is not all the same. In fact, it is highly variegated. There are something like 33 million demigods. There's many demigods who are administrated. Each one has some sort of department within the universe. Some of them have big departments, like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. They have huge departments. Some of them have medium departments. Indra provides the rain. Well, that's quite a big department. Not as big as Brahma and Shiva's. Others have, even down to very small departments, like the demigod managing the flies, because there's lots of flies. But there are demigods who manage the flies and the ants and the unicellular little amoebas and other little microbes. Nothing is just going on, just happening, just like that. Everything is being managed. And devotees who were at our program last night, at the end, you all, most of you, took prasadam. So, that chapati you had, which is sort of, you know, somewhere in the system, there's a demigod. I don't know if it's exactly the chapati demigod, but there are demigods controlling your digestion. There are demigods controlling the movement of your eyelids. The blinking demigods. There's, you know, it's something to do with Vayu managing the movements of air within your body. Yeah, and all sorts, you know, the digestive process and all these internal processes, the movement of blood, the functioning of the nervous system. There's even a demigod controlling the growth of your hair. And if somehow, well, I don't know exactly, but it may be that if you have, in a certain respect, not been as pious as you could have been in some activity, then the demigod controlling hair doesn't let your hair grow so well. Maybe you go bald at an early age. Of course, for the Hare Krishna devotees, that may be good. You'll save money on razor blades and shaving foam. But, amusing though it may sound, it's a fact. Every little particle within the material creation and every little function going on within the creation is being controlled by different demigods, and there's a big, complex network of them. And it's not just, you know, a handful controlling things. And no chance. There's a massive network of millions of them controlling functions from the very biggest scale down to the most minute scale. The digestive processes of an amoeba. I don't know if you call them amoebas in Finnish, but the little unicellular little bacteria, microbes, whatever you call them. Little unicellular things. They're not things, they're people. But their internal processes are being controlled by some demigod or demigods. Yes. So you've got this whole network of demigods. Each one has different responsibilities. They do not really overlap. One, like Indra, we know from Govardhan Leela, Indra is controlling the rain supply. Vayu is controlling the wind supply. The wind supply, how the air moves. And they do not overlap. They're two distinct functions controlled by two completely separate people. And everything is going on like that. And if you want wind, you know, maybe you're in, it's now becoming little popular. Maybe you've gone into the business of generating energy through these big windmills. I don't know if you have them in this country, but I flew over Denmark about a year ago or something, and in the sea, there's all these massive windmills, loads of them, So, of course, they would be praying for wind if they were on the more pious side. So they would choose to pray to Vayu if they understood the Vedic system, because then they'd get a nice supply of wind generating lots of energy, and they'll make lots of money. If there's no wind, then they're going to lose money. But others like Nanda Maharaj, Upananda, and the various other cowherd men of Vrindavan, their practice had been to pray to worship Indra, to pray to Indra, because they wanted rain. They didn't bother with Vayu. They never did anything for Vayu, but Indra, they used to do huge Indra puja. We hear what the puja they did for Govardhan Hill. All they did was take everything for the Indra puja and just use it for Govardhan puja. But it was their normal process to have this massive, massive offering to Indra with thousands of food preparations and all sorts of opulence and things. Those foodstuffs, they were lined up in front of Govardhan Hill. They extended 5 kilometers along the front and 1 kilometer back from Govardhan Hill. 5 square kilometers of food. There would be lots of prasadam afterwards, wouldn't it? And they had so much sweet rice, as an example, and different types of sweet rice. Along the side of Govardhan Hill, the surface undulates, if you know what that means. It ripples. It goes up and down. And there are small valleys. When I say small, I mean not even as deep as the height of this room. But still, they go down like maybe several feet, a few meters into the ground and come up. They were filled with sweet rice. You could have dived in and drowned in the sweet rice. What a way to go, some would feel. But that was all for Indra, not for Vayu. Vayu, other people were interested in Vayu. And then others, like particularly the children and younger people who are still being educated, they would worship Saraswati. And there's a whole different process for worshipping Saraswati. It's just the whole thing is different and she's a different person. But now, this impersonal idea that Srila Prabhupada mentions here, that we'll worship, he mentions Kali. If you like eating meat, then you can worship Kali, because she accepts an offering of meat. And if you're a meat eater, that's good for you. But if you... Anyway, like that. So they will say, and they do say, it is the process, it is called the process of worshipping the Ishta Deva. Ishta Deva means your chosen deity. The one who's just right for you. So people are really into eating meat. They would worship Kali. And others who are into learning things would worship Saraswati. Those who are farming people, like the inhabitants of Vrindavan, would worship Indra. But now this impersonal idea is that it's fine. You can worship who you like. You want to chant Hare Krishna? Good. Go for it. We'll worship Kali. But it is not true that all is one. It is not that all is one. Actually, there are many. There are so many. So many demigods. So this is the impact, or part of the impact, of impersonalism. Impersonalism it applies, or it is working in different ways on different types of people, but this is one way. Another way that impersonalism is working on people is, for example, racism. That we are the best race, of course, because I'm a member of this race, it must be best, because I'm the best. And everybody else, who needs them? They're all useless. Or at least they're less than us. But actually they're not. On the spiritual level, the real level, they're equal to you. And what to speak of the people, but even all the little, even those little microbes that we mentioned, they're also equal to you ultimately, or in the real sense, as actual living entities. So this idea of racism or nationalism, the Finnish are the best. And the Swedes, what a bunch of silly fools. And the Americans, please don't even mention the term like this. So it's all part, or it's connected with impersonalism. Because we're seeing people, living entities, to be less than what they are. That's impersonalism. So racism, nationalism, it is also a manifestation of a type of impersonalism. Sexism, the men are the best. And women, what can you do with a woman? We just keep them around just to be nice to them. Or the other way around, the women are the best, and the men, what use are men? This is sexism. It's also impersonalism. We're seeing ourselves as being real people, having real value, and other people have less value. But actually it's not true. They don't have less value. They have the same value. So this is also the influence of impersonalism. This is why Srila Prabhupada, when he composed his second pranam mantra, Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Vacharani Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastichyadishtarani, we offer our humble obeisances to Srila Prabhupada, who's the servant of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And particularly we offer our obeisances to him, and we recognize and appreciate and give credit to him for preaching in the Western world and defeating voidism, impersonalism, nirvishesh, and voidism, shunyavad. Prabhupada felt that, at least in one sense, his great contribution as a preacher outside of India was combating impersonalism. And voidism means a Buddhist type idea that nothing exists, which is in another sense also a form of impersonalism. Everything becomes so impersonal that nothing exists. So, in many ways, impersonalism has infiltrated Western society. like in Christianity. There's a lot of impersonalism in Christianity. God is light. That's straight out of the impersonal, you know, sort of perspective. God is love. It's such a stupid idea, but it's impersonalism. So like this, even the idea that Jesus is God. God and I are one, or however he put it. It's also impersonalism. Sri Sri Gaurinitai Ki Jai. Yes. So Srila Prabhupada, he was very expert in preaching against impersonalism and voidism and anything for that matter. But he really felt that the infiltration of impersonalism and voidism throughout the whole world was like a very special part of his preaching mission. There are the classic impersonalists. They're the classic impersonalists. Like the Mayavadis. They're classic impersonalists. They're very serious about it. And it's highly philosophical. In fact, it's too philosophical. It's just mind-boggling, actually. But then there is neo-impersonalism, New Age impersonalism, which is not so deep philosophically, not so technical, but it's still impersonalism. Like when I was young, the Beatles put out a song with a ridiculous name, I Am the Walrus. You have walruses in northern Finland. Maybe not, maybe. Anyway, you know what a walrus is? The big seal with the big sort of fangs, whatever. Morris. Okay, so I am the Morris. And in that song, they sing, I am you, and you are me, and we are all together. This is neo-impersonalism. It's like cheap impersonalism, lacking the sort of technicalness and the intricacy and sophistication of Shankarite impersonalism. It's like impersonalism for children or people who think like children. So there are many slogans like that. I remember, Srila Prabhupada mentions in a number of places the idea propagated by many impersonalists that actually we're all God, but the problem is we've forgotten. But actually we're God. So now all we have to do is remember that, oh yes, oh right, okay, I'm God. Well, that's fine then. And that's it. We've done it. We're there. So Srila Prabhupada spoke against that idea, criticized it strongly on many occasions, that if you're God, but now you're forgotten, now you're under ignorance, then what does it mean about you being God? How could you be God? It means that ignorance is stronger than God. In other words, it's just a nonsense idea. It doesn't make sense. So, some years ago, it was maybe, anyway, 10 years ago or so, there was one family. They were in the process of becoming devotees in Durban, South Africa. The son, who is now one of the pujaris in Krishna Balaram temple in Vrindavan, the son was already a devotee. The parents were on the way. They were, but they weren't there yet. And the father was the leader of a particular impersonal Hindu movement, which is very popular. You know, in one sense, we're not meant to mention any names, but the gentleman had very fuzzy hair, and he just died right in the middle of our Rath Yatra in South Africa. Actually, we found out, oh, he died. So, you know, no prizes for guessing who he is. You know who I mean? Okay. So the father was the leader of that organization in one area, the area of Durban where our main temple is. But still he was in the process of becoming a devotee. But he wasn't there yet. So the son, who was now a devotee, was trying to preach to him and point out defects in that person's philosophy. But he wasn't. He had just become a devotee. So he wanted other devotees who were more experienced to help him. So what he did, he brought a book written by, if I may mention his name, so-called Satya Sai Baba. And he gave it to me and said, look at this book, please, and just tell me what's wrong with it. I just opened the book. And just the very first page that I just spontaneously opened to, Sai Baba said, actually, we're all God, but we have just forgotten. Now all we have to do is remember. And then I understood, not that I'd really thought about Sai Baba much before that, but I understood, oh, he's a New Age impersonalist. That's what he is. But they say he's an... No, they say many things. But he's just a New Age impersonalist. And Prabhupada was expert at tearing them to pieces. There's a slogan which was concocted by... one other neo-impersonalist, Ramakrishna, who was a big Kali fan. And that slogan is, service to man is service to God. This is new age impersonalism. Serve man, serve God, serve man is service to God. So in the name of this philosophy, they have a whole welfare mission going on. Anyway, the thing is, Srila Prabhupada once was speaking to some men. It's in the conversations books. Prabhupada is speaking to some men, Hindu men in India, who believe this thing that service to man is service to God. And so one of the men said to Prabhupada, well, you're telling us to serve Krishna, but service to man is service to God. Prabhupada immediately turned it right around on him so brilliantly. Srila Prabhupada said, well, if service to man is service to God, service to God must be service to man. No one had ever done that to that person before because he became just silenced completely. If service to man is service to God, then service to God must be service to man. Because if two things are equal one way, they must be equal the other way too. And then Prabhupada explained that an intelligent person will consider, all right, if these two things are equal, then Which is easier? How can I more easily get the same result if they're equal? And Prabhupada said, you try to serve man. First of all, there's 6 billion of them. You try and serve them all and make them all happy. That's a big job. That's a totally impossible job. For that matter, you try to take one man and serve him to the point where he's just fully satisfied permanently. Not just for today, but permanently. Actually, you can't even do it with one person. But Prabhupada said, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yome Bhaktya Prayachati Tadaham Bhaktya Paritamash Nami Prayatagmaha. You offer me with love and devotion a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, and I'll accept it. So Prabhupada said, just see how easy it is to serve God. It's so easy. Just one leaf. Krishna does not even say, give me two leaves. Krishna specific, in Sanskrit, there's singular, and then there's dual, and then there's plural. In English, I don't know about Finnish, but there's either singular, one, or there's plural. But in Sanskrit, there's singular, dual, and plural. Different forms of nouns. So, Prabhupada made the point, and, well, you can just see it in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna specifically uses the singular form of the nouns. One leaf. He doesn't use even the dual. Give me two leaves. Two flowers. Three flowers. Use the plural. He uses the singular. Give me one leaf, one flower, one fruit, and just a little water. In devotion, I'll accept it. In other words, Krishna will be pleased. Krishna will be so fully satisfied. And eternally, if you carry on rendering service to him nicely like that, Krishna will be eternally satisfied and happy with you. You may have heard the story from Mahabharata, how Krishna visited Hastinapur just before the battle of Kurukshetra, final attempt to negotiate peace. So he went there to see Duryodhana, and he just arrived unannounced, and he met Duryodhana in the street, and Duryodhana said, oh, you're here. Please come to my palace for lunch. We'll make a feast for you. Krishna continued walking around. He met Vidura, who was his devotee. And Vidura was so happy to see the Lord, he invited the Lord for lunch. Now Krishna had two invitations for lunch. And unless you're one of these major prasadam fanatics, two lunches will be too much. So Krishna had to make a choice. Either the royal feast with Duryodhana or Vidura, who was very poor actually, whatever he might provide. So of course Krishna is attracted by the love of the devotees, so he chose Vidura and he went there. Vidura and his wife were so happy. Our Lord is here. We can serve him lunch. And Krishna was so happy to be with his beloved devotees. But they were so poor they had nothing to offer Krishna except bananas. So the wife was peeling the bananas. And in her sort of, you know, so being so enthusiastic, she became a bit bewildered. She was giving Krishna the skin and throwing away the fruit. And Krishna, being under the influence of Yoga Maya, being bewildered also to some degree by the love of his devotees, was accepting the skins and eating them. And Krishna said, "These are the best bananas I've ever eaten." Now, generally people don't eat the banana skin. I don't know about in Finland, but everywhere else, generally, they don't eat the skins. And in fact, I never have, so one assumes that they don't taste nice enough to eat. So, Krishna accepts the loving offerings of his devotees. And when the devotees really have love, it means Krishna accepts eternally. It's not just he accepts today, but not tomorrow. So Prabhupada made this point. Service to man is service to God. Well, service to God is service to man. What's easier? Service to God is so much easier. Just so much easier. You know, some materialistic person, even you serve him a meal, if you're not a good cook, even if you do it with love, he won't appreciate. Because he's just interested in enjoying a nice meal. So, yes, this impersonalism has polluted so many things. So many things. It's amazing. Even in just secular society. But particularly here, we're hearing about those Griha Maidis who just want to perpetuate their material existence through making pious, but actually like cheating arrangements to get material enjoyment. And hopefully, they would say, to go on life after life, making these cheating material arrangements, worshipping the demigods to enjoy sense gratification, as if this is the goal of life. For us, as devotees, you know, generally as devotees, we do not really struggle with the desire, for example, to worship Lord Shiva. If you were from a Hindu background, it probably could easily be a major challenge. A major challenge. Should I worship Lord Shiva or Krishna? Oh my God, I don't know what to do. It's a real challenge for many. But for us, it's not a challenge. Of course, worship of demigods is a grihastha activity anyway. It's not an activity for brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, or sannyasis. But for Krishna-conscious grihasthas, it's extremely important, it's essential, it must be done, that avoid becoming a griha maidi. Not in the demigod worship way, but just in the general materialistic way of becoming a griha maidi. In the name of being a householder, just enjoying material activity, material sense gratification, and just saying, well, I'm a grihastha, I'm allowed to do these things. It's not so simple at all. And it will catch up with you. And after some time, you'll lose your Krishna consciousness and just sort of dissolve back into material existence, and the devotees will look around for you, where are you? But because you dissolved back into material life, the devotees will not be able to see you and you'll be lost. It's a very real danger. As for people who are brought up in a Vedic-type society, like a Hindu society, as there's a very real danger of getting distracted by demigod worship, so for Westerners, there's such a real danger of entering grihastha life, but then becoming distracted by sense gratification. and in that way losing your Krishna consciousness, even losing it completely. Or if not losing it completely, losing so much that, you know, it's hard to tell really whether you're a devotee or not, or, you know, something like that. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Any comment or question? Yes, Maharaji.
Maharaj, I have the story of how easy it goes, how it affects to us, this I am God, you are God. I'm staying now with one devotee who told me yesterday evening that she met on the street some girl who said that actually Jesus has already here on this planet and he's in South Korea, reborn there. And she had this person had a very good faith on that fact. And actually she persuaded this devotee to one of their meetings. And there they had these testimonies of how Bible tells that Jesus is reborn in Korea and all sort of this nonsense. And this devotee was affected by this story. And I was quite astonished because I was thinking she's very intelligent. Why are you believing in this? And I said that did they show you the place in Bible where it said? Said, well, actually, that was one thing I didn't remember to ask, where it's there. I said, but it's not there, actually. And how come you are so attracted by this story? Because can't you see it's, you are devotee, you should know.
Well, you know, I would say that the problem, the root of the problem, is not just that, you know, she sort of lost her and she wasn't intelligent enough to see through it. But the root of the problem is more like she's become weak in her Krishna consciousness. Her sadhana, her association, her involvement in Krishna consciousness. And as a result of that, has become attracted to material life in general. And, you know, the intelligence then becomes weak in a spiritual sense, even though the person may remain materially clever, you know, like maybe able to calculate some mathematical thing quickly, or, you know, a sign of material intelligence like that. But real spiritual intelligence has been lost. If not lost completely, but certainly reduced tremendously. So that when confronted with this, she doesn't just see through it, you know, bang, what a lot of nonsense. But she thinks, oh, wow, really, okay, you know, and starts to contemplate and consider. So the way to help a devotee like that, I mean, of course, you have to also counter the specific arguments. But the thing that will really make the difference and help them to come up again is to get them, help them to become stronger in Krishna consciousness. You know, she's probably not chanting.
Maybe not so much.
Or at least not so much. And, you know, like this, the intelligence, the transcendental intelligence has just kind of faded out. Yeah. Well, it happens to some people who are devotees. You know, one of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's sannyas disciples became a Christian, a Bengali, became a Christian and built a church in Vrindavan just over the road from the Krishna Balaram temple. It's not there any longer. I don't know what happened to it, but when I first went to Vrindavan, just kind of over the road and about 100 meters to the right, towards going out of Vrindavan, was this small church. oh, what's it doing here? And it was built by one of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's sannyas disciples, who somehow or other lost it so much that he became a Christian, and he said that for me, he wrote a sort of like autobiography, how I became a Christian. And he said, the most difficult thing for me was to start eating cow flesh. He said, but I knew I had to do it to make it complete. And he said, so one day, you know, I didn't really want to do it in one sense, but I did it. And then I felt right. Now I've really changed. I've made the transition. So, of course, we shouldn't underestimate the power of Maya. We also shouldn't overestimate our strength in Krishna consciousness. And we shouldn't underestimate, you know, how there is a possibility for us to become bewildered if we don't really keep properly situated in the society of devotees and in the process.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Guru Maharaj, just about this point, what you said about this sannyasi disciple,
right,
who then became a Christian, it's a little bewildering to me that, like in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that whatever we do in Krishna consciousness is never lost, that we continue from that. But then on the other hand, it's said that if one goes away from Krishna consciousness and is maybe doing some offenses, like this particular person must have done offenses,
right,
there are some serious punishments,
sure,
for them. So how to reconcile the two aspects?
Well, you know, nothing's lost. Krishna says that very clearly. So it remains, but it becomes covered. And it's a question of degree of covering. Because in chapter 9, verse 3, Krishna says, Ashrada Dana Purusha Dharmasyasya Parantapa Aprapya Mamna Vartante Mrityu Samsara Vartmani. Those who are not faithful on this path of devotional service, they fall down and they return to the path of repeated birth and death. So if someone becomes offensive enough and just confused enough, then their Krishna consciousness can be very covered, and it can take a long time before it comes to the surface again. And in the meantime, they can just go through some very horrific experiences, and, you know, it can be a very severe type of thing for them. But otherwise, if the devotee is just sort of, you know, weak and struggling, but continues to struggle despite having sort of fallen down even to a substantial degree, but if the devotee continues with the struggle, then the recovery will be much quicker. At least, say, in the next lifetime. If they fall down, but they're still trying to be devotees and they associate sometimes, or, you know, like that, but for this lifetime, they just can't get back into devotional service nicely, then it's quite possible in the next life they'll become devotees again and be able to continue on more easily. Is that okay? Mani Raj.
Yes, Maharaj. There's I have met sometimes some persons who were practicing Krishna consciousness or following some Indian teaching to some degree,
right,
and became Christian. So, also quite many of them still are vegetarian. So, in a positive sense, also I feel that discussing with them that they still have some patients, they said it's too much to eat meat for them, that it's
right. Yes. But unfortunately you get some who really become envious and, you know, aggressive. But yeah, sure, you get all different types. You get so many different types. And when we meet them, we should try and help them. Give them something Krishna conscious.
Guru Maharaj, how is Krishna controlling the devotional life of the devotees? In that there are some people who come to the temple year after year and they only get it together to be in the Sunday feast. Some people join the ashram but they are too attached to their previous home and their hobbies that they really can't get it together to really start practicing Krishna consciousness. But for some, they just like, they get some mercy from Krishna.
Well, Krishna says in the 11th canto, how does that verse begin? Well, I forget how it begins. But Krishna says, someone who develops faith in hearing about me, what's that verse? And is not too materially attached and is not too materially detached can become perfect through following the process of devotional service. I forget how the verse begins. It's in the 11th canto.
It's like Yachradhaya Mat Kathayo.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the word, what's the word? For good fortune through the association of devotees. Just eludes my brain for the time being. Also, Krishna said that someone may develop faith in hearing about me through good fortune. And as long as they're not too materially attached or too materially detached, means they're not impersonal, then they can become perfect through the process of devotional service. So it's not really like Krishna just gives more mercy. It's more dependent on them, what's their condition. Some people are too materially attached. Got it. Krishna. I mean, that was definitely Krishna. Yadrichaya. This is a very important word. Yadrichaya means by good fortune. Matkatado. Developing an attachment to my kata. Yadrichaya mat katado jata shradhas tu yapaman na nirvino na ti sakto bhakti yogosya siddhida. The one who through good fortune, which means the association of devotees, develops faith in hearing about me, and na nirvino. And who is not too detached, na atisakto, and is not too attached, bhakti yogosya siddhida, can become perfect through bhakti yoga, through devotional service. So some people, they're just too attached materially. I mean, more often than not, the type of person you're talking about, it's not that they're too impersonal, but it's more they're just too materialistic. And so they can't sort of break through. And Krishna does not force them. This is what Krishna does, is not force them. In many cases, Krishna only really starts forcing sometimes when the devotee has become more determined and is really actually trying to move forward systematically and go beyond just being like a regular visitor, but is actually, you know, making or has made a commitment to the process of devotional service, Krishna sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, then forces if the devotee gets a little off track, Krishna kind of forces them back onto the track. In one sense, it's also just reciprocating with their desire, because they have a stronger desire than the visitor, you know, the regular visitor. But it's also Krishna's personal intervention. Yeah. He really gets involved with the devotees. Ye vajanti tamam bhaktya, mayi te teshu chapyaham. That for one who really is devoted to me, who is a friend to me, I'm a friend to him. Means I help him or her become more Krishna conscious. Otherwise, you know, you get the famous category of devotee. They're devotees, in the broad sense. They are part of the Sunday program. I mean, they visit the Sunday program regularly. And they normally arrive, you know, if in the temple there is an arati just before prasadam, it's the last part of the program, before prasadam, they normally arrive at the end of the arati, while the fan is being offered. We used to, in the old days, we would refer to such devotees as Krishna's fan club. Because they arrive when the fan is being offered. So the desire is not strong. And Krishna doesn't interfere, usually. He may just sort of, you know, encourage them a little, carry on, carry on. But not like, okay, you know, we are moving forward now. Whether you like it or not. You need to learn a good lesson now. Bang. Something happens by his arrangement. That's more for those who are serious. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj ki.
Jai.